Support for today's episode of Script Apart comes from We Screenplay. If you just completed a draft of a script and are wondering what next, well, you need to check out We Screenplay. We Screenplay not only offers amazing free resources, like virtual events where your questions are answered by Hollywood's leading professionals, with incredible 72-hour turnaround, format-specific feedback tailored to your specific goals, and a price that no one else can come close to, We Screenplay coverage is used by thousands of writers in every phase of their careers, from emerging writers still finding their voice all the way to Oscar winners. So if your script is all ready to go, check out one of We Screenplay's labs, where dozens of writers have been repped, optioned, and staffed as a direct result of the real-life industry meetings and hands-on workshops offered by We Screenplay. Don't stay stuck. We Screenplay want to help. Check out We Screenplay by visiting wescreenplay.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from our friends at Arc Studio Pro. Arc Studio is the screenwriting software used to create incredible shows and movies, such as the acclaimed Netflix animation Arcane. It has a ton of features designed to unlock your creativity on the page, whether you're a seasoned industry professional or a first-time writer discovering your voice. Arc is all about minimum distraction and maximum ease of collaboration. There's an outlining whiteboard for mapping out your story, automatic draft management for keeping those scripts safe, and it also offers real-time collaboration similar to Google Docs, making it the easiest way to run a professional writer's room or just to write that great idea for a script that you have with a friend. Try it today. Head to arcstudiopro.com/scriptapart, where you can get $30 off a pro account by using the code FRIENDS at checkout. Click the link in today's show notes to take your screenwriting to the next level. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Script Apart, a podcast about the first draft secrets of great movies and TV shows. My name's Al Horner, and I don't know about you guys, but lately I'm getting the feeling that I came in at the end, that the best is over. 24 years ago, a man stepped into a therapist's office, and with those few words, transformed television forever. I'm not exaggerating. That man was, of course, Tony Soprano, a great big brooding bull of a mob boss, whose violence as the head of a New Jersey crime family hid a subtle, sweeter side to his personality. The Sopranos balanced scenes of his brutality with glimpses at his humanity. And it was these dueling elements that powered the series, created by our very special guest today, the one and only David Chase. Tony was a doting father with a twinkle in his eye, the kind of guy who had wade into a swimming pool in his dressing gown to play with a family of ducks. That is, of course, when he wasn't wading through a sea of cocaine and criminals at his favourite hangout, the Bada Bing. He was complicated, and with that complexity, to put it in language that Christopher Moltisanti would understand, the series took a hit out on basically everything TV execs thought they knew about the kind of protagonist that viewers would root for on the small screen. Walter White, Don Draper, Bill Hader's Barry, Tony Soprano walked so those other morally dubious men could run in years to come. On its release in 1999, The Sopranos exploded into pop culture like a pipe bomb erupting in Artie Bucco's restaurant. It kind of goes without saying that all these years later, the show remains as beloved as ever, making it such an honor to welcome David onto Script Apart today. In the conversation you're about to hear, we talk about devising The Sopranos' iconic ensemble of characters. We talk about what David and members of his writing team, a staff that includes past Script Apart guest Terry Winter, took from the 1990s political ether and poured into the show's storylines. And crucially, we also discuss how the question that drives The Sopranos isn't which family will come out on top in any of the show's vicious mob disputes. It isn't whether Tony will be caught by the cops or if he'll make it out alive. It's whether it's possible for a man with so much blood on his hands to better himself. The turf war for Tony Soprano's soul. Recorded before the writer's strike, this is a conversation up there with my favourites that we've featured on Script Apart. I've had the pleasure of speaking with David a few times before, but this was far and away my favourite encounter with the legendary showrunner yet. A huge thank you to him for being such a brilliant guest, and a big thank you as ever to our Patreon supporters for helping make this episode possible. If you'd like to access ad-free episodes, as well as our new bonus video segment, Postscript, head to patreon.com/scriptapart, where you can get involved for the price of a single monthly cup of coffee. We really do appreciate your support. Two pretty big announcements to put on your radar before we dive in. First, a new 10-part BBC series that I wrote kicks off this coming Thursday. It's called Walt Disney, A Life in Film, and it's the story of a man, a mouse, and how they imagined a new America together. It's available on the BBC Sounds app from June 29th, so go search it out if that is of interest to you. I'm really proud of it. The other thing to tell you about that is arguably even more exciting is Scriptapart is heading to Spain for our first ever live show. I'm really excited for this because we have with us a very special guest. Mike Flanagan, round three. Yes, it's happening. Hot on the heels of our Doctor Sleep and Midnight Mass specials with the horror auteur, we're going to be tackling The Haunting of Hill House with Mike live at Celsius 232 Festival. The festival runs from July 18th to the 22nd. We're going to be chatting with Mike in front of a live audience, and I could not be more excited. This is going to be a lot of fun. The conversation will, of course, be recorded and made available as a podcast episode later this summer. But for any Spanish listeners who'd like to be there in person, head to celsius232.es for info. All right, the best is not over. Contrary to what Tony thought, the best is yet to come. Let's dive into the episode. Here is the incredible David Chase discussing the first draft secrets of The Sopranos. Thanks again so much for tuning in. You're listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demeck. Okay, it is such a privilege to have with us David Chase, the man who revolutionized TV, as he's so commonly described. David, let me begin by asking you what your relationship is like with that label. I can't imagine what it must be like to turn on the TV in 2023 and see characters and stories that may not have been possible without the trails that you blazed. Is the enormity of that ever overwhelming? How does it all sit with you?
I can't say it's overwhelming, honestly. And sometimes I think it's not true, although it's been pressed upon me so many times that I guess it is. Sometimes it feels really good, frankly. It's a hard one to answer. If it's true, I'm glad of it. TV really needed an overhaul. And I guess I could explain it this way. Maybe I've said this to you before. You know, there was an Elvis Costello song before you were born called Radio Radio. Have you ever heard that song?
Yeah. My dad loves that song.
There you go. Well, the lyrics are, some of my friends sit around in the evening and they worry about the times ahead, but everyone else is overcome with indifference and the promise of an early bed. You either put up or you shut up. It's only inches on the reel to reel, but the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you feel. And I used to listen to that song and say, that's what I'd like to do, is come out with a song or a show like that. And in a sense, that is what I was trying to do. I was feeling in a very revolutionary mind at that time. I was so fed up with television, and I really thought it was dangerous. And maybe I was right, because look where the United States is now after all those years of that. I began to think that one of the things about Donald Trump that made that possible here was that Americans were so used to being fed lies on that screen from commercials, just pounded into their head every day. And the more TV you watched, the more televised lies and bullshit was thrown at you. And I think we got used to it. That's just my opinion. So I think it had to change. And I guess the way I would explain it is just doing what we did and writing what we did and producing what we did was so exciting and so much fun, really. and I don't use the word fun very often, that we all knew we were doing something different and that it was right. Whether or not it would survive, we didn't know, but it was right.
That's really interesting. I remember Terry once told me that TV at the time was...
Don't listen to Terry Winter. No, go ahead.
Well, he once told me that TV at the time was, there were stories to fill the air between adverts for soap, and David Chase was not interested in selling soap.
Not at all. No, I wasn't. You know, I came to Hollywood to be a film director and had nothing to do with TV. When I was younger, I loved television. I mean, as a kid, The Twilight Zone I loved. I loved the Jackie Gleason show. I loved detective shows. But then right at the end of high school, well, in college, I remember watching The Run, Fugitive, and I liked that a lot. And then it just faded. Didn't want to see it anymore.
The creative legacy of the show is well-documented, in terms of the storytelling that it's helped inspire. Are there legacies, though, outside of its footprint on the world of TV that you are especially proud of? You know, for example, there seems to be a real correlation when you go back and dig through the data between The Sopranos going on air, becoming this huge sensation, and then this explosion in men referring themselves to therapy in its aftermath. I can't believe that correlation is an accident given the enormity of The Sopranos and obviously how central therapy is to it.
Well, that one is true, and I do feel proud of that. We went to a luncheon at the, I can never remember, the biggest hotel, old hotel in New York, of psychiatrists. And they told us there that their business had increased tremendously with men coming in. And that felt really good. I mean, a lot of people needed to feel better. I never imagined that would be the case. And as far as other legacies go, well, what you're telling me, the first question, and I'm going to try to be more concise. what you're telling me about changing television, it's hard to explain. I am very proud that there's a different landscape out there. How much credit I would take, I don't know. But I just know that when we were doing it, we knew, that's all I can say, we knew somehow we were right. We knew we were right, and we knew, and maybe the reason we knew we were right was because none of us cared if people liked it or not. We really stopped thinking about that. Will they understand that? Will they like that? Will they hate him? It was a very pure experience if you're a would-be artist.
When we talk about the show being about therapy in a way and it having an impact on how therapy kind of integrated itself in America, was the show therapeutic to write? Like, you've spoken before about the tensions between Tony and his mother being true to the relationship that you had with your mother. You grew up with a cousin and an uncle who were connected, or who you suspected were connected to the mafia. Tony had a voice that was informed by your father, some of the things that he would say and do. Do you remember getting a sense of unburdening or catharsis at all from writing particular episodes or particular plot lines?
I can't say I did. No, I did not. When I wrote those lines or those pieces, and then I saw them filmed, I was always extremely excited and happy to see that my reality as a child worked as a fictional event, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
That people responded to it. That also made me feel that I wasn't wrong, that my feelings of dissatisfaction, all that, of people's, my family's behavior was correct, because I saw other human beings recognize there was something off kilter about what they were seeing.
One thing that I'm aware of in your work, David, is that you tend to write on instinct. Like, you've described in the past how when setting out to write The Sopranos, you weren't necessarily seeking to verbalize something about America, and that it was only as you kind of went through the process of further developing the show that you noticed that this series had the capacity to articulate things about the American dream, the immigrant experience, American masculinity, all these great meaty topics. When we talk about the really rich themes of The Sopranos, where do you think your fascination with those subjects kind of stemmed from in your life? Like, had they always been something you'd contemplated, or was there something at that time, you know, the mid-90s, that placed them at the forefront of your brain as you began to devise the show?
The idea of toxic masculinity was never in my mind.
I suppose it wasn't really a phrase at the time.
No, it wasn't a phrase at the time. But the feeling that something was wrong with America was very much in my mind. And I wrote that in the first episode, in the pilot, and I knew what I was doing. I knew what I was saying. Whether or not people got it, I didn't know. But when he says he feels that he came in at the end, that was kind of me talking. And I had just come from network television. That certainly felt like the end of something, like the end of American culture. Of course, American culture had hit a tremendous low. So I knew what I was doing then. I didn't know that people would pick up on it. But I think it all started, all of that started in the late 1960s when America exploded and the counterculture came to be. And I was part of that. And I was one of those people opposed to the Vietnam War. I thought the situation of segregation in the South was horrible. There were all those assassinations. And I always carried that with me. America became more peaceful for a while, which it isn't anymore, God knows. But I just had a sense that this wasn't the America that I grew up in as a child, which I was very proud of. I was taught to be very proud of it. And I felt very proud of it. My uncle had been in World War II. He had helped defeat the Japanese Empire. We had invented the polio vaccine. Technologically, we did so much. And I was very proud of that America until I hit the age of, 17, 18. I think between the ages, let's say, junior high school and high school, I don't think I thought about it much. And it seemed to be a great place to be, to live in New Jersey and drive fast car, junky fast cars. And America was in a boom, there was a lot of money around. My parents were not rich, but they weren't poor either. But then around 18 or 19, things started getting out of hand. And I began to think, what's going on here? What's going on? I mean, you used to walk around in this country, and everywhere you went, people would say, oh, we never lock our doors around here. And that was true. And that's just one example of what came to an end. And how I would characterize that is that there was the chaplain of the United States Senate gave his opening remarks the day after the children and adults were murdered in Nashville, the home of country music. And he said that we are in the grip of a demonic force. And he wasn't talking like a pastor about the devil, I don't think. But that feeling of a demonic force certainly started to creep into me starting in college. And I think the reason why is I went to the South for my first 2 years of college.
Well, I suppose that's a place at the time where you were going to be seeing the sort of fractures in American society up close. Where did your instinct to become a storyteller fit into all this? Was that kind of pre-existing, or did it emerge kind of in tandem with the things you were noticing about America?
No. Well, you weren't allowed to write about that on network television. It would never even. I co-created an earlier program called Almost Grown, which had that stuff in it, but it didn't survive. And it was nowhere near as forceful, or I don't want to use the word brutal because it would be misconstrued. It wasn't anywhere near as forceful or as dire as The Sopranos. But I didn't become a writer just to express those things. No. And when I sat down to write, that's what came out.
Okay, so speaking of sitting down to write, what can you remember, David, about the day that you sat down to write your first draft of The Sopranos pilot? Like, what was different about that draft? And what was already set in stone in terms of the show this was going to be?
Well, it was also an hour long, and no one was killed. There was no murder in it. And it had the dynamiting of Artie's Restaurant was in there. And Tony contacted Silvio to set that up. That was all in there. The language was a lot tamer, but it still had what Americans call curse words in it. And as I was doing it, I thought, if this goes on the air, this is going to be a train wreck, because it's going to be a huge example of crossed expectations. The network, Fox, is going to be expecting one thing, I'm going to be expecting something else. And the two are diametrically opposed. And so I was kind of, in a way, hoping that it didn't happen. And it didn't. And that really was a lifesaver, because it failed on network commercial television. And then I was able to do it over again for cable television and do it better and do what it should have been. And one of the things, this is going to sound silly and trivial, was I realized that I had made a gangster movie without anybody getting shot. And maybe that's the reason, that might be the reason Fox passed on it. Maybe they felt that it needed that. They never told me, but I fixed that and I made up a whole subplot about Chris killing this guy named Emil Kolar and doing coke with him and then killing him. That's what I remember as being the main differences. And the language got really saltier.
Yeah, I bet. So nowadays, David, when you pitch a show, the expectation from networks is often that you have like a series Bible with multiple series mapped out, this grand plan in place for how this story is going to spiral out. How much of that did you have for The Sopranos? Like, did you know at that point the directions in which this story and these characters might journey? Or was it such a risk that you were just like, let's concentrate on writing the first episode and go from there?
That's what it was. I only addressed myself to making a pilot. I didn't address myself to making a series. One has to understand that the television business, even now, if you're lucky enough to get hired to write a pilot, you need to be extremely lucky to get the go-ahead to film that pilot. Most pilots die on the vine, as what's his name said. If you make that pilot, you got to be even luckier to get picked up for series. Extremely lucky. I mean, how many TV shows were there then compared to the thousands of the network spent fortunes on dead pilots that just went no place. And that's where most people wound up, at least their first time out, or even if they were successful with one show, they could die with the next. And then if they did commit to a series, you'd be really even luckier if it didn't get canceled in the first 9 episodes. So the target was tiny. I mean, extremely tiny. So one never really expected it to happen. You went around doing your work, but you never really expected that you'd get to make a series. So I never thought about a lot of those things because there wasn't any reason to.
In terms of gathering the ingredients for the show, though, David, I'm aware that a son and his mother, that was the starting point for you, that you wanted to tell, you wanted to pour some of your own struggles with your mother into a screenplay. Then the idea occurred to you of making the son more of a tough guy. So you made him a mob boss. Help me connect the dots from there. Like, how did you build everything out from that seed? Like, I'd be especially interested to know how you created the characters in Tony's orbit, because, well, the show is called The Sopranos. It's not called Tony Soprano. And that seems reflective of the fact that there's an amazing ensemble of characters populating Tony's world here, each and every one of them with their own kind of, well, main character life, if you like, despite being in supporting roles. You give each and every one of them the wants, desires, and fears of a protagonist, even though their screen time is more limited.
Yes. And then as time went on, you began to see some of them, their own, what do you call it, main character lives. I didn't really work that out. I mean, I knew he was a mobster. I knew he'd be connected in some way to the five families of New York, that he would have a crew, a posse, right? And it was also a family show, so there would be the family. But that's all I knew. I didn't know who those characters were, and I didn't. There was no architecture that went into it. It was very simple. And over time, we accrued more and more detail.
Did anyone in particular go through any kind of drastic changes from your initial vision of who they might be? Like Carmela, for example, like in the hands of a lesser writer, she could have been an afterthought, but instead she's given such interiority from the very beginning. I'd be curious to hear if she or any other characters went through many different iterations of themselves to become the kind of very fleshed out characters who we came to care about so much.
I'm sure the characters did change, and I'll come to that. I'm pretty sure. But the way the show came to be was I had a deal with a company named Brillstein Gray, and they pitched me the idea of doing The Godfather as a TV show. And I said, no, I don't want, I'm not interested in doing that because there already is one. I don't want to make the TV version of that great movie. And I was driving home that night, and I remembered the script that I had written. It was a comedy. It was a feature script about a gangster with a very difficult mother, and that he puts her in a retirement community, and she wishes him dead. And that was the plot. And I thought, well, I wonder if that would work on TV. And the reason it would be good on TV is because television, as I recall it, there was a lot of room for female characters. There were many female characters. I mean, and if you, okay, one of the most famous TV shows of all time is called I Love Lucy. All right. And there were many, not many shows that good, but there were many shows like that. And so because it was something, the television set sat in your home and you watched it with your family, there was a lot of families and a lot of women. So Carmela's interiority just came because I had decided to do this show that might appeal to women. So I just then just wrote this character, Carmela. And again, I don't know if I've explained this properly. I wasn't thinking, oh, they'll love this. Oh, they won't like that. I just started to write this woman somewhat based on my cousin, Diana Spizzato, who was kind of tough like Carmela. I mean, I don't mean tough, crude, you know, just you couldn't get much past her. And she could be extremely, I don't want to say destructive. She could be extremely, take you way, way back if she got mad at you.
And who was Tony to you, David?
That's very difficult. To me, he was just, to me, he was a mid-level mob soldier. Who is it? Who's the British poet? He was a foot soldier in the armies of the night, a regular foot soldier, Matthew Arnold.
Yeah.
In the regular foot soldier in the armies of the night, that's who Tony was. And that comes from, I forget what poem of his. There was no Tony. But as I began to write him, little by little, or fairly quickly, he became me, my father, my grandfather, pieces of all of us sort of went into that.
Hey, this is Al, just jumping in to tell you about two of our great sponsors this week. Breaking into Hollywood as an aspiring writer can be a confusing, convoluted thing. Fortunately, ScreenCraft is here to help writers with both the craft of writing and the business of Hollywood. ScreenCraft has everything for your writing journey, from video lectures starring your favorite writers to hands-on career coaching with their excellent writer development team. These guys offer the best screenwriting competitions designed to help your talent shine, featuring judges that really know their genre, from top literary reps to Oscar-winning screenwriters. Hundreds of past winners and finalists have started their careers with the direct support of ScreenCraft. Winners have been staffed on shows at Netflix, Amazon, Apple TV+, the list goes on. They've also sold scripts and been hired to write films for the likes of Universal, Lionsgate, Blumhouse, and Hulu. So if you're an aspiring writer, what are you waiting for? Don't wait to check out ScreenCraft today. Visit screencraft.org or click the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from Arc Studio Pro. Screenwriting to me is all about immersion. I want to stay immersed in that dreamy, fantasy-like state while I weave my story and craft my characters. I don't want to be distracted by anything, and I certainly don't want to be thinking about text formatting. Arc Studio Pro understands that. It's so intuitive, it has a minimal and, dare I say, beautiful interface that allows me to stay completely focused on the story I'm trying to tell. To take your screenwriting to the next level, visit arcstudiopro.com/scriptapart, where you can either download a free version or get $30 off a pro account to unlock its full host of amazing features. Use the code FRIENDS at checkout to get that discount. That's arcstudiopro.com/scriptapart. Okay, let's get back to the conversation. Even in the pilot, it's so well calibrated, like, you know, the toing and froing between Tony's dual lives and his dual kind of sides of his personality. He is loving and he's lovable, but he's also capable of such brutality and monstrousness. So, you know, I think on page 5 of the pilot, he's watching these ducklings with great sweetness. Then by page 9, he and Christopher are kind of mowing down someone who owes them money. And the tug of war between those two sides of him, that ends up sustaining 6 incredible seasons of TV. It's kind of the central fight of The Sopranos, I'd say, much more so than any kind of turf war between the mob families. Can you talk me through kind of how you calibrated that balance? You know, the sweetness of Tony, the capacity for destruction, that toing and froing that we see even in this early pilot?
I was never much of a calibrator.
Really?
You know, seriously, I'm trying to explain this to you and to myself. I wanted to make this show about this guy, and I would sit down and start writing events and dialogue and conversations that he had, and he would come out. He'd be on the page. All right, let's take this for an example. He has two children, a boy and a girl. So was that a calibration? I mean, the American family, that the American consumer family in the 50s, early 60s, was called Mom, Dad, Junior, and Sis. And there were thousands of TV shows like that. So that's what I did. Did I say, well, let's make it Mom, Dad, Junior, and Sis? Yes, I did say that. But I never felt that was calibrating it.
So it's quite instinctual then, just spilling your subconscious onto the page.
Yes, that's true. That's what it was. But there was very, and I think the reason people gravitated to it so much, because it didn't have any of this, well, let's not do that. Oh, watch, don't do this. Or make sure there's plenty of that. Oh, they should have a family dog that they all love. We left all that shit back there. And I think that's what people gravitated to. I think when it comes down to it, I think what they were seeing was reality. They were seeing a real family.
And in terms of that reality, David, and that authenticity, like you once mentioned in an interview, the author Sidney Sheldon, a novelist who would write first and do the research after. So essentially they'd add in the historical authenticity once the emotional core of a story was already on the page. Like when we talk about more so the mob side and how these characters interacted and the things they did, was there an element of that to The Sopranos? Would you in your writer's room, would you kind of write an episode, then do another pass where the focus was much more on double checking that everything that each character is doing is kind of true to your research on the mafia and the inner mechanics of a group like that?
No, we had, once it became a series, we did have a what they call a technical consultant, Dan Castleman, who was a deputy DA in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, which you're hearing a lot about now these days. They have a big big trial coming up there. And Dan, you know, had been involved with, I think, the garbage problems, the mob garbage problems in New York. And what he didn't know, he could find out because he had all these people that he knew, other attorneys or guys that he had prosecuted. And so we had Dan. So before we did anything involving the business, we went to him. We didn't start an episode unless we knew we were on real solid ground. I don't mean real like very, I mean real like reality.
And you know, the show hits the air and it becomes this huge sensation. Like, I'd love to know, David, what was the reaction of the real life mob while the show was on the air, to whatever extent that still existed? You know, did you ever kind of worry about these real life tough guys, how they would react to having a spotlight shone on their world and their processes? Or was that not a concern?
There's a lot to that answer. I didn't worry so much as to how they would feel about a spotlight being shown to their businesses or anything. I just thought they might have a reaction to their depiction, to their history. Was it correct? Was it real? Was it too painful or explosive to be on television? Which is why we never really tried very hard to develop a mob consultant. I mean, I can tell you this story. In probably season six, maybe, I had a cousin by marriage. We'll call him Joe. And he was married to my first cousin, call her Marilyn. And she was much older than I was. My mother came from a very large family. So my mother came at the end. Anyway, there were much older cousins. And I never went to him and asked him a question. I never saw him during the making of the show. And then somehow or other, toward the end, maybe three quarters of the way through, Joe and Marilyn and myself and my wife, Denise, went and had dinner at an Italian restaurant in this town in New Jersey where I had grown up. And we had a good time, talked about the family and all that. And Joe and I decided, you know, what the heck? Oh, and I asked Joe, maybe this was prior. I asked Joe once we started talking, I said, listen, are we okay? He said, and I expected him to say, oh, yeah. He said, well, let me find out. So he finally, a couple of weeks later, called me back and said, yeah, everything's okay. And maybe that's when we made the arrangements for dinner. And we had this nice dinner. And Joe and I agreed to meet at a nearby restaurant on a, let's say, a Thursday lunch. And we were going to talk, frankly, about the stuff, right? About characters and people. And, you know, we would never have used real names, but about mob life. And as time drew closer for that lunch, I began to worry about it. And I began to say, I don't think we should do this. I don't think I should approach him that way. And this could not go well. At the same time, he began approaching my assistant about, could we get his son Springsteen tickets? So it began to form in my head that if we establish this relationship, that would continue. If he had helped me out, it would have been, can you do this? Can you do that for me? Can you do this for me? That was part of it. It just didn't seem like a good idea. And as the day was coming closer, I began to dread it. And then the day before, my phone rang and Joe said, listen, I've been thinking, I don't think we should do this. And I said, yeah, you're right. And so we never did. So you can infer what you want from that. But that goes to show you why it wasn't a good idea that we approach real mob guys to ask them questions.
Were there any storylines or potential kind of ideas for where the show could go that you threw out because it didn't cross that threshold of it didn't feel real? It didn't feel like it was going to be authentic to everything we just described.
Oh, I think there were many, but I don't remember because they were thrown out. I don't recall them. When writers who weren't on the staff would come in and pitch us ideas, often they were just like, you'd have this feeling like you don't get it. Here's why that doesn't work. It doesn't feel rooted in fact. And if you think about it from their point of view, you'll see why they would never do X, Y, or Z.
And were there any particularly difficult storylines that stand out in your memory as, you know, either emotionally difficult because you were having to kill off a character who you and the team had become quite attached to, or, technically difficult, just cracking on the page, getting right in terms of that storyline?
Oh, they were all like that. They were very difficult. It was on one level extremely difficult to write, to make it real, to make it vibrate. On the other hand, it was a delight to write because there was one thing about it that always stood out is that whatever, if you were writing a scene between two people, most likely neither one of them was telling the truth. So what they were saying was all bullshit. Sometimes only one person would be doing that. He'd be lying to the other one, or she would be lying and fooling, gulling, cheating on the other person. And for some reason, writing that way was very liberating, and I don't know why. I guess because there was an inherent truth in that, because my feeling personally is that when people speak intimately, or most likely they're not saying exactly what they're thinking or feeling. And so to actually be able to do that, such that you could write a scene and you could feel like saying to the audience, what you've just seen is dangerous, is hurtful, is ludicrous. That felt like that was the way to go. That felt human to me. And that's what I wanted, was humanity. Writing for network television was mostly not that. Everybody said exactly what was on their mind. Now, that happened on The Sopranos, too. Usually when people got angry, they said what was on their mind. But, you know, network television land was cops, judges, doctors, lawyers. That was kind of basically it. And they took care of business. I would not say The Soprano crew was really taking care of business. They had a business, but they weren't helping. They weren't in service to the community at all.
That's so interesting. And true to life, too, like that idea of at least one character in every scene concealing the truth or concealing what they really think. People in real life, even if you're not a mobster, you know, we're always selecting the truths to share with who we're talking to, the versions of the truth that we're going to present to people, right?
Well, especially in a work situation, in an office. Well, you know, come on, look at The Office. Look how deceitful and untruthful people are to each other in a work situation, because all they're thinking about is their own job and their own piece of it. And it was very, and in The Sopranos, it carried into the home. But I expect that goes on in every family. people don't, I mean, I'm not going to talk about it, but I could tell you examples from my own life, living in my house with my wife and my daughter, that we had the wool pulled over our eyes many times.
Skipping forward to the end of the series, I'm not going to ask you about the meaning of the final scene, David, because I am sure that you're tired of the endless interpretations of it or having to answer them. I am going to ask instead about the feeling the moment that you hit cut to black on the page. Like, was it scary to put a full stop on The Sopranos and on this chapter of your life? Was it liberating? Talk to me about how you felt and how much of the response of that ending you anticipated.
I don't think I anticipated how much impact it would have at all. You know, it goes back to the beginning of our conversation. I consider myself an artist or an artisan, a worker. So, and in the writing and in the shooting and in everything, I had come across the emotionality of what was going on. But when I saw it all put together, I mean, it didn't just all of a sudden appear put together. When we put it all together and put it on a screen and showed it to ourselves, my feeling was, oh, shit, that works. Yeah, that really works. Was it liberating? To a sense, in a sense, I'll tell you right now, I had the best job in Hollywood. People told me that. I had complete creative autonomy. And I had the best cast anybody's ever seen, I think. And yet I had done enough. If we had gone on, I think we would have started to A, repeat ourselves, or probably people who think we did anyway, but repeat ourselves or stretch too far or gotten boring. And I was ready to move on to something else. So it felt liberating in that sense. But I very often started to cry when watching that scene. That's the emotion it evoked in me. And I don't know what that was. It was, I guess, A, the meaning of what was going on in that scene. In other words, it was operating on me the way I hoped it would operate on any human being watching it, story-wise. But also, I was going to be saying goodbye to those characters and those actors. And I don't know what it was, 10 years of my life. So I would get very emotional. Like even, for example, just Meadow trying to park the car. I felt like, with that song playing, oh, she can't park that car. I don't know. I would get very choked up. I'm not going to see Meadow anymore. I'm not going to see her grow up any further. I'm not going to see her get married. I'm not going to see her babies. And that would have an effect on me.
We began the conversation with you telling me that the show was kind of born out an observation of yours that something was wrong with America. Now we're on the other side of this show, and you know, a couple of decades have passed since The Sopranos aired. Do you see, like, where do you sit on the America that was broken then? Is it more so now? Is it fixed? What's your perspective on this, having had, you know, such an investment in that question, I suppose, since the very beginning of your career, David?
It broke. It's broken. And I think maybe there's two kinds of Americans. There's the kind that, well, maybe all Americans feel that it's broken. But there are two kinds of Americans. There are ones who are worried that it's forever. It's only going to continue to break. And there are ones who think, yes, let's destroy it all and start again.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing I can really add to that. It's dishearteningly accurate, and not just about America. You know, the division you describe, that's true of where I come from too.
I think so. I mean, what do I know? You know, as far as that's what it seems like to me. The level of hatred for American against American, I guess it's always been there under the surface. You know, it's called a melting pot, and the melting pot is really hot, scorchingly hot. And when something melts, if a human being melts, that's not a good thing. So when Italian meets a Polish person, yes, we're all American. Let's go watch the fireworks. There's all these different modes of thought and modes of belief and expectations that are crossing each other.
Now you said that, I can see how that feeling was alive in The Many Saints of Newark. And, you know, I spoke to you around the release of that film, David, and you mentioned at the time that there was an idea for a follow-up that you wanted to write with Terrence Winter. Is there any movement on that? Is that happening, do you think?
No, it's not.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Not happening. I mean, Terry and I still talk about doing something together, but I think for me anyway, I can't go back to The Sopranos. Well, I just can't do it. I mean, it would be probably fun in a way, but like I told Edie Falco, it's not supposed to be fun. it probably would be fun, but it would also be very tiring. And I'd think, whoa, I should never have done this. I should have let it be.
Do you think there will be an attempt though, David, to return to that well, as you put it, not by you, but by the studio? I ask because, you know, we're speaking not long after Warner announced a TV remake of Harry Potter. Warner obviously own HBO. So the company with which you made The Sopranos, it now seems to be part of their strategy to retell stories within their libraries. How would you feel about a Sopranos remake, David? Are there protections in place that could stop that happening?
No, there's no protections in place. They own it. They can do what they want with it. I wouldn't want to see it happening because some of those, more and more of those actors, specifically one actor, are gone. They're dead. And those writers will be dead. And I'm not interested in seeing, well, because I'd be dead, but if I could come down as a ghost, I'm not interested in seeing somebody else's idea of what The Sopranos could be, because they have no idea.
I think you're right there. But instead, you do have a new project. There's a new witness protection drama in the works over at FX, I'm told, David. Is there anything you can tell me about that before I leave you?
It's not like The Sopranos. It has a female lead. I'm not telling you the reasons why it's not like The Sopranos. It has a female lead. I have a co-writer on it from the very beginning. The interesting thing about it is, I think, it's based on a script, a TV script that I wrote in 1995. I had that development deal with Brillstein Gray that I told you about. And I wrote The Sopranos the first, it was a two-year deal. I wrote The Sopranos the first year. And none of the networks, four networks at that time, bought it. And I said at the time, why don't we go to HBO? And Brad Gray and my agent, everybody said, no, they don't have the money for this kind of a thing. So I had another year to go on that deal. And they wanted me to write something else. That's what they were paying me for. So I wrote a show called, I believe it was called Safe House, about a woman, a very attractive sexual woman who was married to a guy who was connected to a crooked, a real life airline fuel scam. Russians and some other people got together to jet fuel, make money off of that. And he was killed, and she came in and saw him dying, and she knew who did it. And so she was sent into witness protection with her family, with her children, to protect her. It was going to be star Marga Helgenberger, and it was done for CBS, and they didn't want it, which is so lucky for me because I didn't want to do it. I think I wrote a pretty good screenplay, but I didn't want to do another TV show. And then Sopranos was picked up by HBO, and that show just went into storage somewhere. And a writer named Hannah Fadell, who I share an agency, the agency is the same, wants to do a show about witness protection with a different spin on it. And so she came to me and said, would I be interested in going with her on that journey? It's going to be different than what I had. And I said, yes. So that's what's going on.
Well, I'm so excited to see that, David. I really should let you go. You've been so generous with your time and all your insights.
It was really good to talk to you. I enjoy talking with you. I like the way you ask questions and the kind of questions you ask and your understanding of the show. And I'm so glad you spoke to Terry. That's one thing I do want to say before we stop. I kept saying we, and I meant it. The cast was the best. We had such really talented directors, but also in the writer's room, Terry Winter, Matt Weiner, these were Robin Green and Mitch Burgess. These are like genius writers. And they were working on that show. So I was extremely happy to, I mean, not happy. I was happy, but I was fortunate to have them.
Well, that's a beautiful note to leave things on. Thank you so much, David. It's been an absolute honor chatting with you. Let's do it again sometime.
Take care.
You've been listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demek. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.